This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. For much of the 20th century, liberalism played a transformative role in American politics. Concern over unfettered free markets, poverty, and social instability led to antitrust reform and the creation of an economic safety net for the nation's most vulnerable. It gets a little tricky when you try to label the people behind that agenda. Were they Democrats, liberals, progressives, leftists? Whatever you call them, and whatever they call themselves these days, it is clear their star is no longer rising. The political pendulum has shifted to the right since the Reagan years in the 1980s, and the left has been on the run. The last election, which hinged on issues like gay marriage and the threat of terrorism, reaffirmed the dominance of conservatism in American politics. Democratic losses led some left of center to rethink their message and their role in public life. Today we'll take a look at the ideas from the left, and we'll hear from liberal thinkers on issues ranging from foreign policy to theology. And we'll also talk about why liberals and progressives have been pushed to the margins and about what they can do to inspire the American mainstream. We want to hear from you, both sides of the political spectrum. For those on the left, what can liberals do to propel themselves from the margins to the mainstream? If you're a conservative, how can you keep them there? And do you see a role for liberal ideas in American politics at all? Our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. To start us off, we have Peter Beinart, who is the editor of the New Republic magazine. He's working on a book on the future of liberalism, and he is with us by phone from his office in Washington. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
I just said a lot about the left and how it's in decline and has no influence or very little. How much of that is true?
I think that is true. The left always has cultural influence because it's the dominant force in the American Academy and to some degree, I think, influential in American journalism and in the entertainment industry. But in Washington, where I sit, it is weak. Republicans control, obviously, both houses of Congress and the White House, and they have been able to set the terms of debate with a very aggressive agenda on both economic and foreign policy that has left liberals largely reactive.
How has that happened?
Well, I think it is the culmination of a long-term effort by the right to build institutions that could they could set the terms of intellectual debate. If you look at an issue like Social Security, for instance, that's been an idea that is being pushed on the right, for more than 20 years now. But I think also what happened is that September 11th catapulted national security, made national security probably the single most important issue in American politics. That has been an issue that liberals have struggled with since Vietnam. It took the issues where liberals have a national advantage, the issues of economic bread and butter issues, and moved them down the rank and moved national security up to the top, and that's been a circumstance since Vietnam in which liberals have always had a great deal of difficulty winning.
But you talked about this, and you have written about this. When liberals faced this crisis after World War II, they gathered, they regrouped, and they came up with a strategy.
That's right. One of the interesting things is that the first election of the Cold War, the midterm election of 1946, was in many ways like the elections of 2002 and 2004. Liberals were crushed because the country did not trust them to be sufficiently anti-communist. Today, after that, in 1947, there was a big fight that took 2 or 3 years on the left in the United States, in which anti-communism became the defining feature of American liberalism. And it was that anti-communism that evolved under Harry Truman and then came back under John F. Kennedy, which linked liberals' anti-totalitarianism abroad with their hopes for a more just and more strong United States, that I think is the model, although historical analogies are always perilous, the model of the right kind of spirit that liberals need to recapture after September.
Well, okay, so make the necessary, so adjust the model. How does that, what does that mean in terms of, politics in 2005?
It means that the Democrats could do much more, liberals, seems to me, could do much more when they critique the Bush administration's economic agenda, for instance, not simply to call that agenda unjust and fiscally unwise, which I think it is, but which only appeals to a certain segment of the population. But to describe it as making America unsafe, one of the things you find in the 1950s is that liberals are often attacking conservatives as saying, look, your slavish devotion to tax cuts is actually leaving the government without the money it needs to do the foreign aid programs and the military programs that we're going to need to defeat communism. I think a very similar criticism could be made of the Bush economic policies, which are leading the United States into very difficult fiscal circumstances and forcing us to underfund Homeland Security, making it impossible for us to conduct the kind of Marshall Plan in the Muslim world that we need to promote liberalism there. I think there are many more domestic connections as well.
Wasn't John Kerry making those arguments in his campaign?
I really don't think he was. I think John Kerry's national security message, his positive program for how to make America safe was never clear to voters at all. I think all that came through to them was that this is a guy who was trying to be on, who had had different positions over various different points on Iraq. And I think Kerry, unlike some of the Democrats like Joseph Biden, for instance, never really galvanized in the way that Bush did, even though I think Bush was somewhat dishonest about it, the wellspring of American idealism about going and promoting freedom around the world. I think Kerry never found the language to really connect with the American people on that, as Bush has.
Well, what is the language of promoting democracy abroad in a way that progressives and liberals might find it acceptable?
I think two differences from the way Bush talks about it. The first is to always connect America's effort to make the world more free and more just with our efforts to make ourselves more free and more just. The Bush administration tends to hold up America as a fixed model to be emulated around the world, rather than a work in progress ourselves in which we will inspire the world by overcoming our historical injustices. There is no net sense of domestic mobilization for our own injustice. In fact, there's a total blindness when we do terrible things like conduct torture throughout our anti-terrorist prison camps. The second, I think, distinctively liberal way of talking about this is an element of humility that you don't see in the Bush administration. When John F. Kennedy introduced the Alliance for Progress, big program of economic development for Latin America in 1961, he started off by apologizing, by saying that he recognized the United States had not necessarily been a friend of Latin American democracy in the past. Liberals should talk about promoting democracy in the Muslim world, but they, and the Bush administration never does this, they should talk about the fact that America was behind an anti-democratic coup in Iran in 1953 to recognize that we do not consider ourselves infallible. I think that would open ears in the Muslim world who right now find us arrogant and hypocritical.
In the Muslim world, but what would it do on the American political scene? Doesn't humility sound like weakness?
It can, but I think it is, first of all, it's important because that is the language that will rouse liberals. And I think that there are many other things that liberals can do to convey strength, and not just strength, but idealism, belief in America. I don't think it's just that George W. Bush comes off as tough. He comes off as someone who believes in America's project in the world. For a country without a realist tradition like ours, I think that's always central if you want to engage Americans in foreign affairs. On the point of strength, I think that there's no reason that liberals should not support a larger military. In fact, you could argue that it was Cold War liberals tended to be more supportive of a larger army in the late 1940s and 50s than conservatives did. And in fact, it is John Kerry and Al Gore both did want to spend more on defense than George W. Bush for a very simple reason. They had the money because they weren't proposing to give it away in huge upper-income tax cuts.
Restructuring the Left is the topic today on Talk of the Nation. One of my guests, Peter Beinart, who is talking with us, and you can join the conversation as well. 1-800-989-8255. Brian is on the line from Baton Rouge. Hello, Brian.
Hello.
You have a question for us?
Yeah, well, actually, a statement. I just wanted to say that I think that the reason that the left is on the side is partially due to the fact that both main political parties in this country tend to group their core ideas together and sell them as a whole instead of separating out some of the ones that might not make as much sense or might not have as much appeal. They tend to group them all together and say, you get one, you get them all. And a lot of people, I think, don't agree with that on both sides of the spectrum.
You're saying liberals have too many issues. It's too big a basket.
Well, not necessarily that. It's that ones that a lot of people might agree with, like I think environmentalism is, while it might not have been so popular 15 years ago, I think mainstream America really is starting to believe that there is something we need to do about it. But most people aren't going to go along with it if it happens to go along with abortion rights. So, I mean, I don't know. You know, you
all
may...
right. Peter, do liberals have to narrow the scope? Thank you, Brian.
Well, I think that the caller is putting his point on a finger on an important question, which is that parties are always coalitions of different groups, different issue concerns, and you have to send the message. The trick for a party, it seems to me, is to send a message of inclusion so that people can vote for the candidates of that party, even if they don't agree with all the issues of the party platform. But it then becomes important what you stress, what it seems to be at the party's core and what seems to be peripheral. One of the things that I think Democrats need to send is that it's not just the right to abortion and expanded health care that is at their core that defines the party, but also a strong national security and a belief that this threat from what I would call totalitarian Islam is real. So that when someone like Michael Moore, who was identified by many as one of the leaders of American liberalism, says, as he writes as he has, that there is no terrorist threat, compares it to pneumonia and to car accidents, that liberals should say and Democrats should say, this is not someone who speaks for us. This is not someone who we feel comfortable in a position of leadership. And I think that sends a message about what is at the core of the party.
Well, John, and again, you've written about this, and I do want to follow up. You've talked about people like Michael Moore and the what they communicate. John Kerry was very clear, it seemed to be, about how he felt about terrorism and the terrorist threat to the United States. What do candidates have to do to distance themselves from people like Michael Moore if that's what has to be done?
I don't think it's that complicated. I think Bill Clinton gave a model in 1992 when he went to Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition, and in front of an African American audience, he said that he attacked a rapper named Sister Souljah and made it clear that there were currents in the African American community, at least in the entertainment industry, that he would reject publicly. John Kerry never had such a Sister Souljah moment, and I think it's often you need to make clear to the American people not only what you're for, but who does not speak for you, what your party is not. And I think John Kerry was never willing to do that.
All right. We are talking about the future of the left. Peter Beinart, I want to ask you to stay with us and listen to this program. We're going to bring in some other guests as well and then come back to you at the end of the program. Take a short break right now. When we come back, Jim Wallace, the author of God Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. Taking your calls at 800-989-TALK, emails at TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We are talking today about new thinking on the political left, and you can join the discussion by calling us at 800-989-8255. Send us an email at TOTN@NPR.org. Last election was a wake-up call for many Democrats and members of the left about the role of religion in politics. With us now is Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners magazine and author of the book God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. He joins us from a studio in Mid-America Ag Network in Wichita, Kansas. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be here.
So the left's got to get religion?
Progressives are taking back faith and values. Asking, for example, how did Jesus become pro-rich, pro-war, and only pro-American? And really, they're taking back their own progressive history here. Virtually every social reform movement in America, abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, labor law reform, and most famously civil rights, was fueled in part by religion, by faith. And the Democrats were vitally linked to a civil rights movement just decades ago led by black churches. Where would we be if Martin King had kept his faith to himself? Where would we be now? So I think taking back this issue of faith and values and recovering a moral vocabulary, I think, is crucial for the progressive movement.
I want to talk about that vocabulary, though, because you posed the question, how is it that that Jesus became the representative of the rich, et cetera?
Right.
Progressives, people on the left, perhaps feel it's inappropriate and uncomfortable to invoke the name of Jesus at all in politics.
Well, Martin King, for example, was not a member of the religious right. He talked about economic injustice and racism and war, issues the right doesn't talk about. But he neither was he a secular, he wasn't part of the secular left. He talked about Jesus and Jeremiah and Amos. And he talked about it in an inclusive way, a welcoming way. Everybody was welcome to the conversation. So Baptists like him and Catholics and rabbis and people with no faith at all. We need a new moral discourse about politics. Religion does not have a monopoly on morality. We should make that very clear. But a moral discourse, nonetheless, is what Americans are hungry for. And so we've been going around the country having town meetings virtually. And you know, everyone's coming, and they're Jews and Muslims and Christians, young people who say, I'm an agnostic, but thank you for making me feel included tonight. I feel spiritually inspired. So it's not going to be sectarian, but all of our faith traditions contribute to this conversation, which is really a new values conversation about politics, but not just one value or two, but a much deeper, broader discussion.
Give me an idea what that conversation sounds like.
Well, the Republicans, you know, are comfortable with the language of faith and values and God. They almost act like they own the territory, own God sometimes. But they say, in effect, there's only two moral values issues, abortion and gay marriage, two important issues that need a deeper moral conversation, I believe, on all sides. But my goodness, I'm an evangelical Christian, and I find 3,000 verses in the Bible on poverty. So fighting poverty is a moral value. Protecting the environment, God's creation, a caller talked about that a moment ago, is a moral value. The ethics of war, when we go to war, how we go to war, whether we are truthful about the reasons for going to war, these are religious and moral questions. And so how to, in these conversations, they're wide-ranging. It's about personal and social responsibility. It's about, you know, how do we really define economics in a moral way? How, you know, right now there's a budget conversation. Budgets are moral documents. They reveal the values, the priorities of a family or a church or a nation. So how does this budget, for example, that we're talking about now, how do we do a moral interrogation or a values audit of a budget? Who suffers, who benefits, who wins, who loses, who bears the brunt of fiscal responsibility and deficit reduction? Good things, but are those least able to bear it going to, or are those most able to bear it going to? Those kind of things open up a conversation beyond left and right. The country's tired of left and right and wants to deal with right and wrong, I think.
800-989-8255 is the number to call. Earl is on the line from Sag Harbor. Earl, welcome. You have a question for us?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the town hall meetings, that's great. But part of what we lack, I think, are the skills to be able to speak about this, about faith, about religion. Mm-hmm. And doesn't that need to be something that's introduced early? Don't we need to, in school settings, don't we need some new sort of equipment, some new tools to be able to talk about this stuff when we're young? Because the assumption of religion being a personal, private thing, which is kind of what the left has been assuming for some time now, is it lets faith develop, really kind of radicalize in isolation from secular culture and from other faith traditions.
I think you're right. When religion or values are hijacked by the religious or the political right, it's because no one's talking about it on the progressive side. So we concede the territory. And you're also right, early on, we ought to be talking about values. Values should be the conversation about the American political future. I tell Democrats they should talk about values first and policy second, principles first, program second. People respond to vision and values. And we're in this bifurcated world of left and right, and we need to talk about solutions, a politics of solutions. Most Americans want that. They want to know what's right and what works on the ground. And so I think that new values conversation, really, it also can bring us together and find some common ground. You find common ground by moving to higher ground. And I think for too long, values are wedges to divide us and destroy us, not bridges that bring us back together again on the important issues.
I don't think anybody would argue with that, but I wonder how changing the vocabulary from political, changing it from political dialogue to religious, changes
not
that.
Not religious. I'm saying moral dialogue.
Right.
I'm not saying we have a sectarian religious conversation about politics. I'm saying in the public square, a conversation is a moral discourse that's informed by religious values, by moral values, by people of conscience who aren't religious. So we don't have a conversation about who knows the most Bible verses or, goes to a church or synagogue most often. But we've let the right hijack the symbols of faith and values, and that's not good for the country. It's not good for for social change.
All right, let's go to Portland, Oregon. Randy is on the line. Randy, you have a question?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks. I agree with everything that's been saying here, your current guest and Peter and everything. But, you know, as important as values are, and I don't mean to marginalize them, we have to also distinguish ourselves. We cannot just try to capitulate in the areas where they've been doing so well and always be so reactive to the right. And I hate to use these terms, but we have to distinguish ourselves as and create a more thorough program and vision, which is an alternative for the America, and to try to get people to come along on those grounds. Values are imperatively important. Morals are, but so are pragmatics, policies, and principles. And we need to, you know, we need to develop a more thorough vision and program that we can articulate well and incorporate those values into. And I think we've really been failing to do that. We're constantly reactive to the right and whatever the particular issue happens to be, or we're trying to put all of our eggs in one basket over an issue. Right now we're just, you know, privileging values and morality at the expense of everything else, marginalizing that. We need to always be a thorough counterforce, an uber force, if you will, and independent of being reactive to whatever the issues of the day are, we have to have, you know, something that we're promoting at the same time, which is much grander than anything that's been talked about by Peter or yourself. And I'd like to hear some comments.
I think you're exactly right.
Thank you, Randy.
The left has been often known for just being against the right. People need to know what we're for and not just what we're against. Protest is good. Alternatives are better, either on national security, on economics. People have to know what we're for. That's why I speak of the politics of solutions. People are looking not just for a critique of the voices out there already. They're looking for things that could actually work. And so being proactive, offering alternatives, and being visionary. People respond to vision. Without a vision, the Bible says people perish. And without a vision, you also lose elections.
Well, let's bring into the conversation now another voice. The fight for economic equality has long been a liberal cause, and as conservatives have gained ground on the economy, some liberals have begun to rethink their positions. Joining us now from the liberal perspective on this issue is Gar Alperovitz, who's the author of America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Joins us by phone from his office in College Park, Maryland. Gar, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
How does the discussion have to change with regard to the economy from the left, do you think?
Well, I think there is the call, both the argument about vision and solutions and a new direction, I think, are necessary. Let me put it this way. There has been an extraordinary shift in recent years in the underlying level of who controls the real economic power of the country. Most people are not aware that it is now the top 1% has more income each year than the bottom 100 million people taken together. Their share has gone up just about double in the last 20 years, the top 1%. The top 1% now, and it's a new situation, owns and controls just about 50% of the financial wealth. These are medieval numbers. And I think one of the things people are beginning to develop, and the press doesn't cover this, is new ideas about how to deal with these concentrations in a way that produces both a vision and the solutions. At one level, for instance, several states are beginning to say we must challenge some of these inequities in tax policy that is not the traditional tax the suburbs to pay for the central city. It is essentially a populist tax. California, for instance, passed a tax this year taxing the top millionaires in order to target money for mental health. Last year, New Jersey targeted taxes of people over $500,000 in order to solve problems that are building up in terms of the very, very costly real estate taxes. Even the state of Virginia Senate passed the taxes at over $150,000, which got changed when the House had to negotiate with them. But these are populist taxes, I think, showing a new awareness that these kinds of distributions just do not produce a decent society. That's at one level.
So you're saying some of the change is already taking place.
Slowly, you know, these things are slowly beginning to develop, I think, out of pain and necessity and out of a realization that you can't have a community if you have vast, vast differences of the kind that really are new in American history, of the extreme nature. And I think the press is just beginning to catch on that that many people are seeing this and acting on it practically and beginning to, in a way, sketch the outlines of one element in a new direction.
Jim Wallace, let me get your response to that. The right may not get it, and the right gets it wrong. The left doesn't get it. Are the people getting it as you travel the country?
I think the question Gar is asking is the right one. Whatever became of the common good? This is a wonderful religious idea. It's personal and social responsibility. We are responsible to and for each other. We all take responsibility, but there's something called the commons here. Community is a central value. And, you know, King talked about the beloved community, a powerful vision. It was behind all the civil rights legislation. It meant that everybody had a place at the table. In the Bible, the economic assumptions are, there is enough, number one, if we share it, number two. And what the Bible rails against is the huge gaps. The profits always rise up when the gaps begin to grow. So right now, CEO salaries to average workers have grown in 30 years from 30 to 1 to about 615 to 1. This is a crisis of biblical proportions, you might say. And Amos and Isaiah would be jumping up and down saying, no, these gaps are way too large for the health and well-being of a good society.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stasio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about the future of the left with my guest Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine. Gar Alperovitz is professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. Taking your calls at 800-989-8255. Mike is on the line from Portland, Oregon. Mike, you have a question?
Yeah, I do have a question. I probably come from a little slightly different point of view because I voted for George Bush. But I previously have been I voted for Bill Clinton previously, a registered independent. And I can tell you what keeps me away from the Democrats is not the social issues. I voted in favor of gay marriage in Oregon this year. But it's the economic issues and the fact that Democrats seem like they want to keep as many people as possible as dependent as possible on as many government programs as possible. That's what I hear from the Democrats, particularly when they talk about Medicare, Social Security. When we had the debate on Medicare prescription drugs, the Republicans were criticized for wanting to have a prescription drug program that only was focused on the very poor and not on middle class or upper class elderly. Well, who pays, you know, taxes on Medicare and Social Security? It's mostly middle class people. And why the Democrats would have opposed a means testing of sorts for prescription drugs. And I don't like the bill that was passed, by the way, but the rhetoric from the Democrats is not that, oh yeah, let's focus the resources for the poorest elderly, but let's not have our government program that's benefiting the upper income elderly or the middle class elderly who may not need that benefit. And it just seems to me that Democrats are focused on keeping as many people as possible as dependent on as many government programs as possible and not focusing resources on the truly needy, which would then free up, allow us to have perhaps a lower tax burden on people who are working their way up the income scale.
All right. Well, let's get a response, Gar.
Well, let me just say that there's three different ways to respond. First, if you look at the president's new budget, the slashes are in the programs above all that are affecting low-income groups and communities in terms of the housing programs, the central city development programs. The current and also the tax benefits have gone way to the top. This is not even in dispute. There are some areas where I think that you can have some modification of health programs, which it would help more at the bottom end. But the truth is that people in the middle class are paying for this now because the programs are so badly organized. People end up at the hospitals in the emergency rooms and ends up on your insurance program. Where the real problem is different, I think, and I wanted to say this. We're talking about the future of where all this goes. One of the things that needs to be done, I think, and is beginning again at the grassroots level, is there are different ways in which direct productive wealth, low-income, middle-income, and poor people beginning to develop worker-owned companies around the country that begin to show a different pattern of ownership that I think also points beyond these current debates that I think we all get stuck in. Most people, again, don't realize there are about 11,000 companies in the United States which are owned substantially by workers. They're all over the place. They keep jobs in the communities. They improve the tax base. They provide the kind of resources that provide for other services at the local level. And they show a different pattern, I think a vision of the kind of community that I think Jim was talking about, that takes us beyond this traditional left-right liberal conversation. Indeed, many conservatives at the local level interested in very practical solutions are looking at these kinds of things. They're even looking, for instance, at new forms of ownership by cities, municipal ownership where the wealth benefits the community, makes profits that can be used for services, are popping up in many parts of the country as well.
Gar, when we come back, I want to ask you more about that and why our caller's perception of the left is what it is if you are articulating this different vision. So when we come back, Wither the Left is our conversation today. It continues in a moment. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now we're wrapping up our discussion on issues from the political left and how does the left regain, if not the high ground, some ground to enter the conversation, the political conversation in the U.S. 800-989-8255 is the number to call. My guests are Jim Wallace, the editor of Sojourners Magazine, and Gar Alperovitz, who is a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland and author of America Beyond Capitalism. Gar, just before the break, you were articulating a vision and talking a little bit about how worker ownership are some of the new ideas we could begin to talk about. But you heard a caller say that, you know, as far as he's concerned, the Democratic Party and the left are tied to these old policies of big government programs, giveaways that are very expensive, and otherwise leave people tied to these programs and prevent them from living, you know, fruitful lives. What do you do about that perception?
Well, I think the perception is partly the creation of a great deal of conservative politics and in this country. That's partly true, and partly there are some programs that I think were badly designed. I think that the caller probably is right about that. But in general, I think he's wrong. And let me say why, and then return to this issue of the new directions that we need to go in. By and large, this is the richest country in the history of the world. If today the economy is producing $150,000 for every four people, and at the top it's producing several million for the top 1%, the society has ample resources for health care for everyone, and it's obvious that this is not a poor country. The basic decision that was made, I think, correctly by Roosevelt, and it ties in with the value of rebuilding a community that's a democratic community, is that many of our programs must be for all the people across the board. And in some circumstances, that may mean taxing back for the rich. For instance, if you get Social Security payments for everyone, there's no reason you shouldn't tax more the rich. But in general, we need to rebuild things that are for all of people rather than isolate very small groups, because what we've learned historically, if you isolate poor and often racially small groups, politically those programs die and those people pay the costs. So I think we do need a general overall posture which benefits large numbers and builds community, and I would go for taxing for the very top extremes when it benefits some people too much. But what I wanted to really say, and I think this is the really interesting thing that's beginning to develop, and why I call my book America Beyond Capitalism, Beyond Capitalism and Beyond Socialism, if you like, there is a recognition at the grassroots level in many, many parts of the country, partly because of the failure and pain now being caused by the government and by the failure of government programs and by the Bush administration, that wealth is critical and that it must benefit more people. I mentioned this growth of these worker-owned companies the last 30 years from just about zero to about 11,000. More people involved now than there are members of unions in the private sector. There are 3,000 or 4,000, maybe 6,000 by some estimates, neighborhood-owned corporations building housing and spreading wealth in that way to benefit neighborhoods. Many municipalities, under Republican as well as Democratic mayors, going into business to provide resources for the community as a whole in cutting taxes or at least supplementing taxes. There are also land trusts, which are neighborhood land organizations that are nonprofit that own housing in order to prevent gentrification. Many of the state levels are public investment programs. All of this is beginning to develop a new vision about how wealth can be used rather than the 1%, literally just 1% owning almost half of investment capital in the country. And with whites owning 33 times the financial wealth of blacks and literally 99 times the financial wealth of Hispanics, there's got to be a change in the underlying patterns of ownership. And I think it's slowly beginning to sketch a different vision of where we might go in an America that's beyond both capitalism and socialism.
All right, Gar. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Gar Alperovitz is a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland, author of the book America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. And as Gar suggested, the civil rights and race is an issue that is part of this discussion. In the civil rights era, progressive African Americans and white liberals were the ones who pushed hardest for racial equality. To talk about where the left stands on social justice is Patricia Williams, professor of law at Columbia University and a columnist for The Nation magazine. She joins us from a studio at NPR's Bureau in New York. Patricia, welcome.
Thank you.
To what extent does race play a factor? Is it a factor in this discussion?
Well, I think it's both it's a hyper-visible factor and at the same time a rather invisible factor. It's invisible to the extent that the core of the Democratic Party is not Sister Soldier and it's not even Al Sharpton. It is what is so often disparaged as the civil rights establishment. It is the NAACP, the Urban League, and I suggest people go to those websites to see what it really is, because it's not what Bill O'Reilly says it is. The heart of the Democratic Party, the heart of the progressive movement is African-American and Hispanic, who serve in the army in greater numbers, who are morally quite conservative, who are the most church-going of people, who are the heart of the union movement. So I think we have to think about what is already within the Democratic Party that is extremely mainstream. I think it is hyper-visible to the extent that I think that the Democratic Party and progressives have been cowed, almost shamed or scolded as politically correct when the question of equal opportunity or leveling the playing field comes up. And I think it's incumbent upon us to know the figures so that you have, on the one hand, many, many people who feel like African Americans are taking over affirmative action means that minorities are chasing better qualified white people out. And at the same time, they're saying this against a backdrop of a city like New York City, where 50% of all African American men between the ages of 18 and 65, that's literally everybody of working age, is unemployed. This is a shocking statistic, a crisis, as one of your previous guests said, it's medieval. But it's invisible. It's invisible, and yet the sense of the few of us who have made it to some kind of public intellectual status are viewed as being everywhere. And I think that that disparity of perception affects not just the right, but also the left.
Well, what do you do about that?
Well, I think one thing is that we need to stop worrying about whether you're going to be shamed or scolded again as politically correct. I think that word, the moment you hear politically correct, look farther, read the statistics, read the data, collect the data. I think secondly is to resist the upside-downness of the language, which has been set as the terms of the debate by the right, this notion of reverse racism and reverse discrimination. That takes thought. So you have cases, for example, there's a South Carolina case, for example, of a school district that attempted to put a magnet school on a site in the middle of the district's position so as to attract a cross-section of all races, ethnicities, and socioeconomic strata voluntarily. In other words, a school that would serve everybody. But this was attacked as impermissible state action because race was used as a criterion at all. Now, this is upside down. In other words, the very attempt to integrate has become a violation of equal protection. That was not held up by courts, but on the other hand, one of the reasons I'm so very concerned about the course of the judiciary is that the Fourth Circuit, for example, is only one vote away from making that sort of thing a violation of equal protection. So that the very attempt to integrate, the very attempt to take race into account as a balancing measure is upside down. And I think we need to feel a sense of kinship across all kinds of lines, because if you can do that, if the inclusion of African Americans is understood only as the exclusion of white people, then collecting data about women in the workplace can be characterized as discrimination against men. Statistics about firing older white men when they hit 40 or 50 can be turned upside down as discrimination against young people. And we have a senselessness of discourse. And I think that that's the consequence of allowing one side to set all the terms of the debate.
Let's go to the phones. Lawrence is on the line from Berkeley, California. Lawrence, you have a question?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm really happy to hear this conversation about community on the as a leftist ideal, because from where I stand in Berkeley and in San Francisco, my fellow leftists are not very good at it. And I'll give you an example. 2 years ago in February, we had an anti-war march before the war actually got going in Iraq that had 200,000 people in it. And after the march, we all meet at Civic Center. There's 200,000 people there, and the march leaders give us 3 hours of speech-making. Instead of asking the people, mm-hmm. will they organize themselves, will they organize into small groups and go back into their community and organize more people, we have got to get better at organizing ourselves into effective communities and going out and creating more communities, because the media won't do us for us, and lecturing people won't do it either.
Let's, Patricia Williams, can I start with you, get a response, and thank you, Lawrence.
I do think that the degree to which we are organized and the degree to which we do have institutions shouldn't be taken lightly. I think that people need to turn, as they never have before, to organizations like the ACLU, to their local coalitions of women's groups, minority groups, now Legal Defense and Education Fund. All of these have been so disparaged and devalued, and yet they've done so much of the community building and the coalition, the cross, the inter-ethnic conversations, the kinds of conversations we need, not just against the history of the traditional civil rights movement, but given a globally diasporic world in a time where everybody is being motivated more by fear than thought sometimes. I think we need these traditional civil rights organizations. We don't have to start all over again. We do have these institutions. Again, I suggest going to the websites of these places to really see what the litigation is about. I think it's a good, deep, refreshing breath to see what we do have.
Well, the existing art organizations, but Jim Wallace of Sojourners Magazine was the listener, and he's not here to ask. I got the sense that he was also talking about a more grassroots, forming other organizations.
Yeah.
That were looking at this problem progressively and then coming up with their own solutions.
I think the progressive side has to reframe the debate. It's got to reconnect to constituencies they're not connected to, and it's got to rethink some big issues. Patricia is right to say the issue here, for example, inclusion is a positive value that most of us support. Community, these are positive opportunity. You know, 9 million working families in this country, people who work hard and full-time, are not making it. Work isn't working. If you work hard in America full-time, you shouldn't be poor. Most Americans believe that. Responsibility, personal and social responsibility. These are words, values we have to take back and not let the right define things as dependence on government programs, reverse discrimination. These are twisted ways of talking about the debate. So let's reframe the debate in terms of values the American people really do respond to and will.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stasio, sitting in for Neil Conan, and we are talking today about what the left can do to reclaim some of the political high ground. And I want to thank two of my guests, Jim Wallace, who heads the Call to Renewal and editor of Sojourners Magazine, and Patricia Williams, professor of law at Columbia University and a columnist for The Nation magazine. Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you.
Peter Beinart of the New Republic magazine, I want to bring you back into the conversation to maybe sum up and tell us a little bit about what you heard. We're ending on this note of community and whether or not there has to be a way to reconfigure the left and get people sort of to know that they're a part of this, if that's part of the issue.
I think absolutely. And I think that I think community has always been central to what distinguishes liberals from conservatives. Liberals and conservatives both have a belief in liberty, although they define it differently. But liberals have tended to focus more on this question of community, particularly as it relates to discrepancies between rich and poor and between historically disenfranchised groups and the rest of the population. And I would just add, because my work is really on national security these days, that I think liberals should remember that it's not just that national security is an important issue in and of itself, and it's an issue on which they have not convinced the public, but it is also itself can be a mechanism for rallying community. It is one of the things, one of the ways, if you look at John F. Kennedy's campaign in 1960, that he talked about American community was that this country had to be strong and united and just enough to win in the world against the threats we face. And if you look at the way that George W. Bush has divided this country, I think there's no question that he has made it weaker, and that language about community has a national security element as well.
Of course, one of the things people would argue is that we're all just too busy. We're too busy working and trying to make ends meet and getting most of our information from mainstream media so that we're not really even developing our own body of knowledge, our own database to form a community.
Well, that may be true, and yet I think there's evidence of a great deal of civic and political activism out there. Gar Alfritz and Jim Wallace were talking about some of it. Turnout was relatively high in this election. There is an enormous amount of energy in the internet on the liberal side, and certainly in the religious community in churches. There is a real awakening and a connection of people to others. So I think that there is, yes, it's hard for people because they have these other concerns, but I think, as Jim Wallace was saying, there's also a yearning out there for that.
When you talk about reframing the debate, that came up several times in the hour. I mean, how do you do that?
I think that is really what's very difficult. I don't think that can be obvious. It can only be done to a small degree from Washington by the way that national politicians speak. I think one of the great problems that, for instance, bedevils the work of someone like Jim Wallace, someone who I admire his work, is that Democrats might talk about poverty in the language of religion and morality, but people's views about how they apply their religion politically, I think, are being influenced more than anything else by their local communities, their local religious communities. If we have a situation in this country where it is, certainly amongst white Americans, where it is conservative religious communities, conservative evangelical churches, which are the ones that are drawing people to them, and the liberal mainline churches are losing membership, that will be the framework for how people understand morality, to view it through the prism of abortion and gay rights, not through the prism of poverty. There's only a limited amount that the Democratic Party can do from Washington about that. It has to start with people's grassroots communities, because those are the communities that frame how people absorb national political messages.
We've talked a lot about issues. What about the personalities? Is there anybody out there who you think can frame this vision and express it?
I don't think we know yet, but I do think that it's very significant that John Edwards had made poverty an important part of his presidential campaign and seems to be focusing on that over the past few years. It has been too long since a Democratic candidate of national stature has put poverty at the center of his message. And I think it's significant that Hillary Clinton, who represents for many what American liberalism is today, has been trying to find ways of talking about abortion that recognizes the moral dimension involved in that, and has also been taking positions on national security that I think are quite at odds with where people like Ted Kennedy have been and where people like Howard Dean have been. So I think those are both two important people to watch.
All right, Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Beinart is editor of the New Republic, currently working on a book about the future of liberalism in America. Mr. Beinart joined us from his phone at his office in Washington, D.C. In Washington, I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News.